Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Getting Hammered. I am your host, Mary Catherine Hamm. I'm here with my co-host, Vic Mattis of the Washington Free Beacon. We are your morning show for any hour. We're going to be talking about, we got a Trump update. In court, it has begun. We're going to talk about Israel, the Middle East, going through it. Absolutely going through it right now. We have some Hill updates. Those aren't good. And we'll finish with NPR and some gender dysphoria and treatment news. Does that sound like an exciting show? All right, so get ready, everybody. And we won't be drinking for this one. I know, I don't want to disappoint. But last week, the people enjoyed the drinking. How's it going, Vic?
Hello, Mary Catherine. Yes, as you know, last week / weekend, I was in Notre Dame, not in France, but rather in Indiana, in South Bend, which, by the way, I thought my knowledge of Indiana is not that great. And I know Indianapolis is like way down south, I believe, right? It's along the river.
Sure.
I thought South Bend was where Lafayette is, which is like southeast of Chicago. No.
I also know all of these cities' placements.
Oh, good. Thank goodness. Yes. We're that good about real America. South Bend is actually very close to the Michigan border.
Oh, yeah.
And I also forget that Indiana has like a shoreline on Lake Michigan. Sometimes in my mind, I'm thinking about how it's, you know, like Illinois, Wisconsin, the border, or Michigan. But Michigan is split between Ohio and Indiana. I had to refresh my memory.
I know where Gary is.
Along the way. It's in between. It's in between South Bend and Chicago.
Right.
That I knew.
So, and from the Jackson 5.
Yes, that's where Michael Jackson. Yes.
And from the song.
Oh, from the Music Man.
Indiana. Yeah. Not Louisiana. Okay.
It's a great song. So I was there. It was my first time to the University of Notre Dame, courtesy of Carter Sneed and the DeNicola Center for Ethics and Culture.
Nice.
What a wonderful time. Carter's a great guy. The students were really nice. I have to tell you, I was kind of jealous because, not even kind of, I was full on jealous because I'm walking through campus and all the kids they're wearing the merch, you know, and they're proud about wearing that merch to Notre Dame. I think it's one of the biggest sellers of merchandise, right, in the country.
It's not my cup of tea, but
no,
yes,
I know understood. I know it is not yours because it's a different region of the country.
Understood.
Yes.
It's iconic. I'll give it that.
I was jealous because, I mean, they have, first of all, it's a huge university. It's very Catholic in comparison to where I went to school. I think the largest organization on campus is the pro-life group.
Oh, nice.
And they have a real football team and a real football stadium. And you can hate them. And I know I made some jokes about Michigan. They do not take lightly to the Michigan jokes. Kind of a sensitive subject.
Yeah.
But I was kind of jealous about that. And so that was lovely. And I also ate very well. So two things I want to mention on this. First of all, one morning, Carter takes me outside of Notre Dame's confines to Mishawaka.
Okay.
And we went to a hole-in-the-wall diner. It was a Mexican diner called Gio's.
Okay.
And the inside of the diner looks like somebody's like a rec room basement from the 70s. I mean, like, it's just like there.
I love that.
It's just tables and chair. I got myself a Mexican skillet. Carter had huevos divorciados, which is the eggs are separated by like the rice and beans, and it's green sauce and red sauce. Here's the thing. First of all, the flavors were unbelievable. The skillet was chorizo and potatoes
we
and
love
the
it.
Egg, and it comes with a side of pancakes. We get the sort of the greasy menus, right? They've been there forever. You can tell
naturally.
They've had it there. It's like covered in the sprays of all the various greases and things. So I'm looking through it saying, what am I going to get? And I'm thrown off by the prices because the prices are like $7.95, $8.95.
Oh, yeah.
$7.95. I'm like, is that an appetizer? Because, you know, here.
No, that's your meal, my friend.
You're not getting anything for $7.95. It's like the city. So, you know, I got the Mexican skillet, and it was a lot, and the flavor's just bursting. So they really know how to eat in Indiana.
Love
that's
it.
What I'm going to say.
Love it.
Have you been to
Indiana?
Yeah.
Yes, I have been, although it's escaping me on what occasion at this point. Oh, to visit relatives, distant relatives who live in Indiana. I've been up there a couple of times, enjoyed it. Like I said, familiar with Gary.
It's very flat,
yes.
The land. But you were going
to
say.
Your story reminds me of when I first got to D.C. And then I would go back home to North Carolina for holidays and buy beers. And I would be at the bar like, are you sure this is correct? I got two beers, right?
Yes.
In fact, at one point when I, now this is dating myself because this was my first job out of college, which was many years ago now, at the bar in town, in this very small town in North Carolina where I worked as a newspaper reporter.
Yes.
Cub reporter, Mary Catherine Hamm, at the local watering hole, you could get a draft light beer for some 79 cents.
No, come on now. That tops anything, even in my memory.
Yeah.
I was gonna,
it's a real thing. Now, I think it was a specific night of the week.
Yeah,
I think
yeah,
it was
special.
A specific hour, whatever.
Yeah, nevertheless.
79 cents. 79 cents.
That's some good times.
Yeah. I believe I took a picture of it at one point. Now, that picture surely doesn't exist because it was probably on like physical film.
Yes, yes. So you actually have to find the actual.
Like, yes, I'd have to find that point and shoot camera
that
possibly.
Picture, yes. On the cellular.
Those are in now, by the way. Which
really?
Leads me to my next story.
All right.
Which is that last week I chaperoned a field trip. It was a full day thing. And on that field trip, the cool kids, by that I mean the tweens, you know.
Yes.
The tweens had the point and shoot cameras with them.
Not part of their phone.
No.
An actual.
These kids don't have phones because we.
For people not watching this on YouTube, I'm making a snapping picture with my finger thing.
So there was a kid with like even the one with the cool Polaroid printout. Now that was fun. I was jealous.
I think
of
people
that
like
one.
The idea of that, and you like.
Yeah, it's immediate gratification.
Yes.
It's physical. You can hand it to your friend. It was very cute. Okay, so I like that. Tuck that one away for present ideas in the future. And it, you know, allows you to do this thing that you see, for instance, me doing all the time, taking pictures as my kids do, because I love that is my favorite thing to do with my phone is take pictures.
Take pictures.
And they see me doing that, and this is an opportunity that they could do the same thing but not have a phone. I like that. Okay. However, I do want to say that chaperoning the field trip. Now, I did not ride on the bus. That's a whole other level.
That's a first question.
That's a whole other level.
Yeah.
It was a long drive. I met the bus over at Luray Caverns.
I was going to ask, where were you going? Because that's like exit one.
Yeah.
That's like in the after, that's where 66 ends and right I-80.
It's about a two-hour drive
out there. Is it 80, 81, I think?
81.
The interstate is 81, yeah.
It's about a two-hour drive out there. Really beautiful drive.
Yeah, it is.
Not mad at that at all. Happy to get in my car.
Go through the Blue Ridge.
That morning and drive through the mountains and see the giant American flags and the wildlife and the livestock.
Yeah,
real America.
Where it's still, things are still normal.
Yes, yes. So I drove out there. I meet them, but I just want to say that this was Olympic level chaperoning of children. For this reason, bunch of kids in dark sweatshirts and jeans in a cavern.
Oh, yeah.
In a dimly lit cave. Okay. So that's number one. And there's one kid who's in my group who like kind of preferred to be with her besties elsewhere.
Oh.
Right. So I'm trying to watch all of them at one time. Yeah.
Now, you're not alone. There's a couple other
chaperones, there's
I hope.
Plenty of people, good, but I good. Did feel a very intense responsibility for the kids on my list, right?
Yeah.
We can't
have
anybody falling in a prehistoric pool and retrieved on my watch, okay? That can't happen. Mm-hmm. We can't have stalactites being damaged by the children I'm supposed to be watching, okay?
Which one is a stalagmite and a stalactite? Did you learn? Do you still remember which is which?
Of course.
Okay.
It's very easy. There's a mnemonic device, which is the stalactites come from the top.
Oh, okay.
Duh.
thank you, very kind. And the stalagmites come from the bottom. Okay.
Would you like me to write this up
for the ground?
Would you like me to write this up for the culture section?
Just put it. Thank you. That'd
okay.
Be very helpful.
Stalactites and stalagmites.
I have another question
with Mary Catherine Hamm.
I have another question for you. In the cavern, I've always wanted. I've been to one of these, but not in Luray. Did it have? It was dank. I assume it's cold.
Yes.
That's why they're wearing sweatshirts. It's cold.
Chilly. It's damp. Yeah.
Does it have like a smell to it?
No, not an offensive smell. It's very impressive if you've never been.
Not
super
to Luray,
impressive.
Okay. And I think there's some great places to eat out there,
And just
too.
To think about, actually, this is impressive, to think about the people who explored that before, you know, there was electric lighting down there, which I get to take advantage of.
Yeah.
It's dimly
of
lit.
They...
But you have guides and you have guide rails.
Yeah,
and
the
idea of people just venturing in there with a torch back when they discovered it sounds horrifying to me. So good job, you guys. Very brave. And it actually did lead to one of the first, if not the first, I don't want to disinformation you guys, air-conditioned homes in the U.S. Because whoever had bought that land and discovered that these caves were under it started pumping the air up into his home.
Wow.
And the air was much cooler, so that's nice.
Very, You know,
we were on the AC so early, Europe. Take it.
The idea that these caverns naturally exist under the earth, going underground, right? You go underground? Is that this?
Yes.
Is right.
It's not I'm a just cave preparing for a conspiracy theory.
Yeah, no, it's not a cave in the
he
mountain.
He felt like he was
right?
gearing up to one.
Right.
Now, why are they there?
The diameter of this cave. No. I was going to say, just as an observation for somebody, again, who is safe from science, the earth is so fascinating.
It is.
That's all I'm going to say. It's just really fascinating.
Okay. I was afraid we're going to go
down
a path.
It's like a cooled. I imagine that it has the smell of if you ever go on the Pirates of the Caribbean ride in Disney World.
I mean,
you know,
similar.
It's cold and that smell is kind
probably similar, a little less industrial.
Okay.
But there is one place called the Cathedral, which is a very high ceiling and all these beautiful formations. It's very big. And there's great acoustics in there. Mm-hmm. And someone, before we had things like regulations that would not allow you to do this, someone built an organ that plays off the formations. Like it echoes off all the stuff.
Yeah,
and
the
way that it looks is so perfect because it's like an old-fashioned organ in the middle of this like creepy
it's area. Like Phantom of the Opera or something.
Even better than Phantom of the Opera. You know what it reminds me of?
What?
Goonies. Remember when they play the bone organ?
Yes, and then the floor collapses if you don't play it right.
That scene made me practice piano lessons so much more.
Okay.
Like, what if I'm in Andy's position someday and I have to pick the right chords?
Two quick thoughts for you. One, do they still play the organ or is not allowed?
People are allowed to play it, but you have to go through a class or something. I think there's some training. And at one point, I overheard the guide saying that there was a YouTuber who came and played it that arranged with them to film him down there playing the organ, and that they don't often have public performances while there are tour groups going on. But she made it sound like it's mostly because people are shy, and I was like, not me.
Oh my gosh, yeah, I'd love to go up there.
I can't believe her shit, but I'll get up there.
No, I would love to hear like Led Zeppelin, the opening to Led Zeppelin's Your Time Is Gonna Come. That organ in the middle of there would be very exciting. The second thing is, I'm so glad that you bring up Goonies because I think Carrie Green was so underrated as an actress of that
fantastic
time.
Fantastic lady.
Lucas also.
Yes. Mm.
Okay. And it's not even like she's a redhead. She's like,
I'm just saying. She was like, also, one last point. Not only did I do the cave chaperoning.
Yes.
We then went to a hedge maze.
Oh.
A hedge maze with children whom I'm supposed to chaperone. I quickly realized that this was not going to work in exactly the way that the rules might require. Like, they're not going to be in my eyesight at all times. And furthermore, I'm probably going to lose them in there because it's a maze.
So it's a real tall maze, like Shining style.
Oh,
it's tall.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. And so I just, like, tried to keep up with them the best I could. And ordered my daughter to be close to me so that I at least had one, right? I can order her around better than the other one. So I was like, you need
she will somewhat listen. Somewhat. But
look,
there's a lot of excitement.
We made it out. We answered the riddle that is therein. Actually.
Oh, we've been in the maze?
Yeah, they have like little, you have to answer a riddle while you're in there. I recommend a hedge maze. Maybe not with an entire class of fourth graders, but I recommend a hedge maze just in general. That part was fun.
Yeah. No, I can't get The Shining out of my mind, so I don't know if I'm going to do that.
It was not as cold as that.
Did you go, by the way, a recommendation while you're out there in that area, that part of the of Virginia? Mm-hmm. A great place apparently to eat is called Spelunkers.
Okay.
And
well, now I know.
My son is there. Burgers and
too
shakes.
Too late.
Burgers and shakes.
You know what? I might go back out because the vintage and antique stores out there.
Oh,
super fun.
Yeah.
I went into one and had to buy this like huge, ridiculous vintage Tonka truck that I found. I was like, the babies will love this.
Yes.
The baby will love this. Piece of lead that I can hand to it from 1973.
It's lead, yeah. It's okay.
It's on a shelf right now. Don't come at me. Okay, shall we? I mean, seriously, a cave and a hedge maze?
Yeah, that's a good day.
Elite,
that is what
elite
you call
chaperoning. Elite.
Congratulations, and also time well spent.
I enjoyed it. Okay, shall we move on to the news?
Yeah, let's do it.
Let's talk about the Middle East. Some things popped off.
Yes.
Vic, while we were
so
off the
speak.
Air, there was an attack from actual Iran, not Iranian proxies, which has been the pattern up until now. Of course, Hamas was acting as an Iranian proxy when it did October 7th. Hezbollah acts as an Iranian proxy when it's shooting from the north in Lebanon, despite the UN's rule that it should not be that close to the border. But I guess international law doesn't matter that much for them. The Houthis are acting as Iranian proxies. And Iran was like, we can't miss all the fun. We have to get on this too. So they sent many, many drones.
Hundreds.
First, yeah. Slow drones. And then on top of that, not just drones, many ballistic missiles. And in a truly spectacular display of technology, intelligence, modern society,
right,
military defense, all the things, Iron Dome and aligned, like allies, both in the Middle East and U.S. and Britain, but notably Saudi Arabia and Jordan, right?
Yeah.
Shot down all these things. Very little damage was done, including none to Al-Aqsa Mosque, which they apparently didn't care if they hit. They were just shooting wantonly. It's the third most holy site in Islam.
Sure.
Israel's Iron Dome just kept that one safe,
right,
which is nice. And now we're at what happens next.
Right. Okay, so first
by the way, there was one injury to a 7-year-old Bedouin girl who is said to be severely injured and in the hospital. So prayers for her, and right, we hope that she can make a full recovery.
And that was from the wreckage from the rockets being shot down.
But the fact that there was no damage is because of Iron Dome.
Yeah.
You don't.
Which some people, I believe, tried to want to defund. Did I forget that? Am I mistaken?
Was a thing.
Who was that?
Anyway, we'll get into all the reacts. But first, your reacts.
All right. Vic. First is the geopolitics of this is really interesting from a distance. I mean, we can make these observations here. Not only is Iran really it's not a neighboring country invading. This is not Iran versus Iraq, obviously.
Right.
This is, they're like 1,000 miles away. I mean, they're launching it. So it's going over other airspace. And then you had, as you mentioned, Jordan, for example, or Saudi Arabia getting involved and knocking things down over their airspace. And I believe Egypt helped out as well.
Credit where it's due.
Credit where it's due. So on the one hand, you have Muslims versus Jews. And on the other hand, you have Arabs versus Persians. And so in that mix, you had what, you know, transpired over the weekend. When it began, when they said, okay, you know, there was a lot of talk. This is, we knew ahead of time this was going to happen. And then because those drones were very slow and it would take 9 hours to reach the targets and they were spotting it in Iran, you know, like I changed my newsletter. I had a funny opening to mine about the Japanese state visit. And I said, no, I think it's taking a serious turn. I actually thought this was it. Like, you know, several waves. I said, this is war. Hezbollah is going in. It's going to be like 67, 73. They're getting attacked, 48 from all sides, Israel. And that's what I thought. What did you think when you first heard this?
In the early hours, I was trying to be as cautious about the freaking out as possible. Also, just, you know, praying for all my friends who I just saw in Israel, some of them, and hoping that it would be something less than the all-out war that we might have been imagining at that time. By the way, when I was there, the army in the north, the message was clearly prepping for the idea that this is imminent.
Yeah.
This is imminent. There wasn't a lot of talk of it coming directly from Iran. I don't think that was the prediction.
Right.
So then we get into like the American reaction and what Iran's calculation was.
Right.
I mean, okay. So there's two options. Like some people are saying Iran didn't, it was just for their internal politics to show that they're doing a thing and they weren't trying to inflict any real damage.
Internal politics, a sop to the proxies.
I feel like if you weren't trying to do a lot of damage, maybe shoot fewer things
into
the air. That's
a symbolic gesture.
A symbolic 350 missiles for you.
Yeah.
And then as far as it's like all out war, you know, we were talking about coming from Hezbollah, but like every single one of these is an act of war.
Yeah.
Open act of war.
Yeah.
So that they know what they're doing, and then partway through, almost like while the attack is ongoing, they start crying uncle.
Right.
Iran says to the UN, this matter can be considered complete or something along those lines. No, it can't. No, it can't.
It's complete after they fired and 99% were shot down by the efforts of the U.S. and Britain, by the way, as well. And of course, obviously, Israel. My first thought was, yes, part of it is, you know, could this just be the symbolic gesture? This is their sop to it. Everyone on their side is saying, you need to get involved. Okay, we got involved. Happy now. Okay, we did it.
Right.
That's the first question. The second one is, are they just testing the perimeter, right? Are they probing Israel's defenses, seeing what they got? Because obviously, Iran has more, and they have yet to unleash that, and Hezbollah has yet to unleash their hundreds of thousands of rockets. And the third thing is, were they waiting for, and they are waiting at as of the taping of this show, Israel to retaliate, and thinking, please give us a reason to go full-scale war with you if Israel even thinks about attacking anything on Iranian right. soil. I think all of that is insane in the sense that the idea that they're waiting, you know, that they're threatening further action if Israel retaliates, if you know, like you're not allowed to hit us on your soil, you literally just launched from your soil hundreds of rockets into Israel.
So that's the question. Like, regardless of how much this is a signal or meant to cause destruction, I tend to think happy to cause destruction because that's what missiles are for when they're shot into someone's territory. And you guys hate the Jews, so like seems like a win-win for y'all and when you're shooting missiles at them. But regardless, that doesn't change Israel's calculus.
No.
Right? Like the aggression is the aggression.
Yes. Noam Blum on Twitter, he had compared this to like somebody getting shot with a bulletproof vest.
Yes.
And the person getting shot is not going to be like, okay, well, that's it. You know, you're fine now until you reload. I'll wait for you and I'll take it more. The idea that Israel is not going to retaliate, and even more, that I was more incensed by the Biden response, which came very quickly.
It's the only thing he does quickly.
Yes, that's right.
Can't takes him 16 minutes to walk from Marine One to the White House. Yeah. But this
was almost instantaneous. Yeah. I sure hope now that, you know, we've repelled the attack that Israel doesn't think of actually doing anything because that would escalate things. They're so afraid of the escalation because right now there's no escalation at all.
Right.
You know, Iran doesn't escalate.
The rules that the international community has set up, and unfortunately Biden has played into, are that Israel can be attacked at will, all day long, every day, from all directions. And when they retaliate, that is considered the ante, they refer to they're allowed to have defensive measures, right? So Iron Dome.
That's how wars of the future are fought, by the way, just defense and just keep coming at you and you just have to defend, but you're not going to go after them.
Well, and as we've said throughout this, the problem with that, even though like I also worry about escalation, right? Mm-hmm. We all do.
Sure.
I fear that when you send the signal that each small escalation has no price, what do you buy yourself? Giant amounts of escalation from freaking crazy theocracies who are happy to annihilate entire peoples.
We've said this a million times, Mary Catherine, which is that in that region, any of these efforts to say, you know, compromise and let's all, you know, get along now and make peace, that's being interpreted as a sign of weakness, not of strength. And the only thing that they respect is strength. A friend of mine recently said, we were at the bar at the Knights, and love the guy, he's great. And you almost never want to talk politics at a bar.
Right.
And he just brought it up, though, and he just said, I hope, you know, that's done, and I just hope Israel doesn't respond now, because, you know, that would escalate things. And I'm on the other side of it. I could not help but start, you know, my son's next to me. I brought him in, and I'm like, okay, just ease up now, because this is not the show. You know, and you're among friends. And
he's like, I graduated from the School of Arts.
Information. I'm like,
it's Georgetown University.
I was like, what? That's like the Allies, you know, stopping at the Rhine, saying, well, we're not going to go any further. We'll just wait for them to build up their forces and come back at us again. This is no way to run it. And I just, you know, his complaint, my friend's complaint was, you know, spending too much on these Tomahawk missiles. All these Tomahawk missiles, they cost so much money. That could be used for anything, you know? And, you know, the money argument, they could be used to buy a car, or health insurance, whatever. You could launch a handful of Tomahawks to take down any of these launch sites in Iran, or you can wait for Iran to launch hundreds of these rockets and then go tit for tat.
Yeah.
Tomahawk, and he's right. They're very expensive. They need to be replaced, you know, and you got to then have the defense contracting companies like Raytheon rebuild and make these missiles and then send them over to our carriers and then arm them on our jets or whatever else we're doing. Not Tomahawks on jets. I get it. But still, or you can just take them out on the ground and save yourself a lot of these extra missiles.
And throughout all of this, the message to Iran from the U.S. has been, don't. But also, here's another bucket of cash. Like, in what way?
Right.
This is dates from the Obama administration and the JCPOA.
Red line in the sign, the line in the sand. The red line.
The ally in the Middle East, the entity in the Middle East most worthy of protection in the eyes of the Obama and Biden administration is not Israel,
no.
This island of democracy. It is the JCPOA.
Yeah.
That is the entity that they are interested in preserving, even though it's a fiction and always has been, written by an actual Ben Rhodes, an actual, I think, creative writing major.
Yeah, so, Ben Rhodes. Yeah.
Feather in his cap. It's been a fiction throughout.
Mm-hmm.
And they're, to me, totally nonsensical need to appease these the mullahs
who are never going to be placated unless they dominate the region. That's what they want to do.
Right.
Israel was on
which
the,
makes who safer? No one.
Israel was on the verge of establishing normalization of relations with its neighbors,
right?
With the Abraham Accords under Trump, and then during the Biden administration it had been furthered, and that is when October 7 happened and everything else changed. Because they don't want Israel to get along with its neighbors. Iran, on the other hand, they want to dominate the region. Israel does not want to dominate the region. They just want to be left alone.
They would
live
like
in
to
peace.
Live their lives. Yes.
And that's not going to happen.
And by the way,
an
amazing thing about Israel is that within hours of this huge existential civilizational scare,
right?
I mean, Cuban Missile Crisis level plus.
Yeah.
There's video of Tel Aviv on the beach, people playing soccer. Out enjoying their lives, out with their families. Mm-hmm. It's a really beautiful thing. It's a very hard thing to do, to leave your house and go out to the beach, to be maybe further from a bomb shelter than you would like, to celebrate the fact that you remain free.
Yeah.
It's a very tough thing to do. I'm amazed by it. Even in the state of war, which was a lower level when I was there, I was amazed that people were so out and about,
And they're used to it.
Yes.
They're used to it.
Which you don't want
here,
to ask them to be.
Right.
And also it's admirable to watch it happen.
I wanted to quote our friend, by the way, A.G. Hamilton,
Yes.
And
a great follow on all of this, or on anything, but on this particular.
He summed up the Biden administration's foreign policy, and I'll just read what he says, which was, Biden tells Iran not to launch an attack. They do it anyways with unprecedented firepower. Biden responds by demanding Israel not retaliate and leaks it to the press as a signal to certain voters. That, that basically sums up.
That's
Their foreign policy. And by the way,
it's not working.
The squad came out and condemned Iran's attack because they said that it's all, it's all bad. We wouldn't want it just to be on one side. They're both sides. At the same time, some of them were explaining that this response was actually a response to Israel escalating things when they hit the Iranian consulate in Syria.
It's important to understand that the ceasefire now starts now. Oh, wait, now. Because their irrational actors and terrorist side that they support wants to continue shooting into Israel.
Yeah.
And they want that to be the status quo.
Right.
Only one side ceases firing in a ceasefire.
Ceasefires and retaliations and stop the cycle of violence. You know how you could stop the cycle of violence? If they just stopped and let them just continue attacking. That's just... Just let it happen.
By the way, at this point, our friend Noah Rothman, who writes for National Review, is fond of saying that all of this is an indication from lefty activists, from the administration, that there is only one reasonable side of this conflict, right? Which is true, obviously true.
Yeah.
The problem is that instead of supporting the reasonable side, they ask the reasonable side to give everything to the unreasonable side.
Because they can. Because as Anthony Blinken says, we hold them up to a higher standard because they're a democracy, so therefore restrain yourself.
This unfortunately incentivizes unreasonable behavior because you are rewarded for it at every turn. And the news about hostages, of which there, I think, remain 5 or 6 Americans.
Yeah, maybe 40 who are still alive.
The news keeps getting worse because Israel keeps offering insane deals
insane
to
deals.
Hamas, 30 to 40, even up to 100 sometimes, of their convicted
killers
and terrorists in Israeli prisons for each hostage, plus all sorts of ceasefire considerations. And they're like, nah, because we can't guarantee we can give you those hostages. So it's getting sadder and sadder and more manipulative. Yeah. And the entire international community is like, well, Israel, what are you going to give them?
Right.
What are you going to give them? Nothing.
Yeah. And, you feel like there's this fading memory of the hostages and certainly the 5 or 6 Americans that I don't believe Biden really talks about.
I don't think he's mentioned them.
No.
That's wild.
And again, right before this attack, you know, we freed up billions of dollars from mm-hmm. them, right? Because yeah. we were holding them in Iraq, and that was for money for oil that was going to go back to Iran. It went back to Iran. Of course, the administration assures us that billions of, you know, the money that they're going to get from yeah. lifting or the expiring of sanctions is really for food. But of course,
no problem. No problem.
That's money that they would have spent on food themselves that they can now spend on, I don't know, rockets, drones.
Money is fungible. Money is fungible. So
people were upset about it.
There was also this video that went viral of the moment at a ceasefire now gathering in Toronto that immediately went from ceasing fire to demanding fire once the organizer announced that it was Iran firing on Israel this time. Like that is an encapsulation of the ideology
right.
that you're dealing with on that side. That ideology has taken over many a roadway in the U.S. in the past couple yeah. days. San Francisco, Golden Gate Bridge,
right.
the road to O'Hare Airport.
Which I was just at.
In Chicago, yeah. New York, a couple of places. And in these places, in a little like microcosm of the issue, mm-hmm. when you don't respond by punishing the people who go outside of speech, you get more of this.
That's right.
Whereas, shall we take a look at Florida?
Yeah.
In Florida, when people block the roads, they are immediately dragged out of the roads and arrested.
Yeah.
They are punished. And wouldn't you know it, today in Miami, there was, as we are happy to have,
uh-huh.
because we have free speech in this country.
That's how this country works.
A protest of a bunch of people I disagree with in the median of the roadway.
Yes, the median.
And not blocking the roadway.
Right. They also
Look
didn't glue themselves to the pavement.
Look at that.
Yeah.
It's almost as if there's a solution to this problem.
So, you know, I'm staring at these images from yesterday, the shutting down of the bridge, and then the protest in New York that we were yeah. just talking about. And, you know, now they're literally now rooting for Iran, right? They're now on the side of Iran and Hamas and Hezbollah. Some of these people are wearing these bandanas, you know, for Hezbollah, Hamas, right. waving the Hezbollah-Hamas flag.
The Hezbollah flag is the one that really gets me because all these like every town adherents, right? Mm-hmm. They're like Moms Demand,
yeah,
gun
sure.
control nuts.
Uh-huh.
They look at the Hezbollah flag and they're like, I don't know, like a terrorist holding an AK as the centerpiece of the flag
right.
in the name of actual theocracy is fine
yeah.
with them.
And yeah, and of course their beliefs would be perfectly fine in those countries,
yeah,
you know, in those
sure.
in that region.
Yeah.
And then the burning, as you saw, the burning of the American
yeah.
flag and the Israeli flag. And I thought to myself, yeah, I'm used to seeing that, but normally that's in the Middle East
yeah.
when that happens. That's like Tehran or somewhere else, not in this country. These people are here. They hate America,
yeah.
and yet they stay here. So I imagine that when they're not doing this, they have other jobs and they're doing other things and collecting checks or whatever it is that, you know, they do. They're here to stay and they hate it.
Yeah, they're pretty obvious about that.
I think
maybe some other media outlets other than just Fox could ask politicians who have Death to
yeah.
America chants among their supporters what they think of that.
It's really,
because I think
really
I
downplayed.
If
yesterday.
I remember correctly, Republicans are often asked
yeah.
to respond to the rhetoric among
mm-hmm.
their supporters or even supporter adjacent, someone who right. happens to be in the crowd. So just like a thing that you could ask them about. I will not hold my breath. Can I play a little bit of
please.
KJP just giving us
a
really good rundown of how the administration is thinking through these
okay.
things before
sure.
we get to Congress because
yeah,
we have
yeah.
to deal with it next.
That's right.
This is a good segue. Here's KJP. See if she helps you make any sense of it.
House Speaker Mike Johnson has said that he'll move forward with a vote on additional Israel aid if Congress were to pass additional aid for Israel, and only that, will President Biden reject it?
So we've been very clear, my colleagues from here just moments ago, that we will not accept a standalone a standalone would actually not help Israel and Ukraine. It would actually delay the needs that they the needs that the needed aid that they obviously need to fight. You see what was happening in Ukraine. Obviously, the brave people of Ukraine are fighting against a tyrant. We need to make sure that they have the assistance that they need. We saw what happened in Israel just over the weekend, and the leadership that this president has shown. It would actually not help them if we do a standalone, and we do not support a standalone.
I'm sorry, what?
If you get the money to them now, it's not going to get to them now. If they have the aid that they need, they're not going to have the aid that they need. All the talking points, by the way, are all swimming around in her head. So she manages to insert, by the way, and greatest leadership of greatest president of all time,
Not good at this. Yeah. And she's really ticked off at everyone else about it.
She'll be the next host of, you know, on one of these shows like MSNBC. It'll be
okay. So we can get to the underlying substance of what she was talking about right there, which is Speaker Mike Johnson has unveiled an outline of his plan to move foreign aid through the House, pitching four separate bills to address aid for Ukraine, Israel, Taiwan, and other national security priorities that he says will all get votes before the end of the week. The strategy sparked an immediate backlash from some conservative lawmakers who have demanded that any additional Ukraine aid be accompanied by tougher security on the U.S.-Mexico border. Proposals excluded from Johnson's legislative blueprint, raising questions about the viability of the speaker's plans. And then you have also the ever-looming threat of ouster, which you may have an update on. This is moving fast.
By now, we may be on to Speaker Hakeem Jeffries. We don't know by the time you're listening to this. Before we taped, Thomas Massey, the congressman, he announced that he is co-sponsoring with Marjorie Taylor Greene the motion to vacate the speakership. And as you know, it doesn't take many to get rid of Mike Johnson's speaker. So apparently, Speaker Johnson scoffed at this. And he says, I'm just trying to do my job. We're doing my job. We're getting things done. Get this aid to Israel. Getting the aid to Ukraine, that's a problem for people on his side, as you know, and that's one of the reasons. And the end result is you may not have enough votes for a new Republican speaker because the margin is down to basically one, right?
And who wants the job?
Who wants the job? This is why people are leaving. I understand. I was just reading a take on this morning about, well, the ones who left were rhinos anyway. They're no help.
Right.
And there are other people saying, well, if we had Hakeem Jeffries as speaker, it would make no difference. It's like having him speaker now. No, it's not. Trust me, the subpoenas, the investigations, the witnesses, all that comes to an end. Everything changes, the emphasis, the direction of the, you know, where this Congress is heading, what they're spending, where we're going, changes completely. It shifts if the Democrats actually take control. So the idea that it doesn't make a difference, that they're equating Mike Johnson to Hakeem Jeffries.
Then you get insane. Actual Hakeem.
No, you, and that's what they're saying. I'll be fine sitting on the sidelines, and I can complain all that.
No, I mean this is
we've had this conversation.
This is a larger issue, but the incentive structure that makes losing dramatically more lucrative than winning incrementally is a problem. Yeah. And look, there are moments when you should lose dramatically. There are moments when you should stand on principle. There's a one. Is it a one vote?
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a one vote. I just have to. It's. In my mind, it's so...
Who do they think? Who do Massey and like Marjorie Taylor Greene
think? I have to check it every time.
Yeah. Who do they think that they have that everyone can agree on that is going to say, you know, manage to pull off, you know, a border bill that comes with maybe with or without Ukrainian funding that gets through the Senate and then gets signed by the president in a situation where the Senate is Democratic and the president's Democratic.
Right.
So... I don't know what they have in mind or who do they think can pull this off. It would be amazing if they could. But
for those who are interested in the weeds, this would be a rule for proposed would be a rule for four bills, separate consideration with possible amendments for each and a mechanism to combine them. There's also it's not like there's no support for Ukraine and Israel aid. Right. There is large support in the Senate, especially with some considerations. Right. With caveats. But it's not like this is unpopular. But because the margin is so narrow in this House, you have to bring enough Democrats that doesn't turn off too many Republicans. You have to bring enough Republicans that doesn't make Democrats feel weird. And I don't mind the idea of splitting them because I'm not sure there's another way to get people to consider this stuff.
Can I give you the counter argument?
Sure. Yeah.
Shut it down.
Well, this is okay. If you want to get down to like bare politics of it,
I've heard both, literally.
If you want to get down to just electoral politics of it, which I'm sympathetic to the id that says, shut it down. I hate all these people. Mm-hmm. I get it. When trying to win elections, mm-hmm. one must put oneself in the shoes of a normal person.
Yeah.
Now, people who care about politics as much as we do are not normal. I would argue, Vic, that you and I are normie adjacent.
Yes.
We like might be as close as you get.
Yeah.
In this town.
In this town.
But you have to try to imagine what normal people might like. And one of the things that normal people might like is basic function.
Yeah.
Which means not ousting the speaker every 3 months because you don't like him.
Because, I just want to know who their ideal. Who do they think amongst their fellow Republicans is going to be the
Maybe
one?
Maybe it's you. Have you ever thought about that, Vic?
You know, it's
we could just
some
make
of the perks. I like the
we
perks.
We could just make cocktails from the dais. Can you do that?
I imagine that you could, you know, I mean, I've had the food in the dining halls before. It's pretty good. The cafeteria.
That's, of course, where his
Longworth,
mind goes immediately.
The Longworth cafeteria is mm-hmm. it's
well,
not
think
bad.
About this. As Speaker, look.
Yeah. Or is it canon? I don't know if
you're not going to move to Kentucky and be elected anytime soon, which would make you like a real funnel for like cool bourbons, right?
Oh,
those
yes.
would come immediately to your desk.
Right.
However, as the Speaker, you cover the whole territory of the U.S. You are
all
elite.
The goods from everywhere.
Right. You're an elite to all
That's right.
the areas of the U.S., which means you could call in all the liquors. And by the way, as we've discussed many times before, you don't actually necessarily have to be a House of Representatives representative to be the Speaker.
My phone is, I'm waiting by the phone.
It shall happen. All right. So that's the rundown there. Yeah. I don't know. Whatever. There will be some other update before this even airs. So
there
Good yeah. luck to all of you. Okay.
We're doing great.
Can you talk to me about what's going on with Trump?
All right. So the hush money trial, the trial for the hush money okay. is now upon us. Stormy Daniels. This is the story about Trump's paying off through Michael Cohen, Stormy Daniels, to not talk about, I don't even know if you want to call it an
Their
affair.
Relations.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. During a terrible time when I believe Melania was pregnant or just had the baby and he was doing this. None of that, by the way, is a surprise. This is not shocking. It's terrible. We know about this. However, the trial is because the hush money was mislabeled, as you know. It was misreported on
right.
a business expense as a legal expense.
Right.
And if you do that, Mary Catherine, that is a misdemeanor. Oh, wait, we're trying him for a felony.
Yes.
Also, it happened a long time ago, so the statute of limitations expired. Oh, wait, we managed to change that, too.
It is remarkable.
So, Alva, you know, the Justice Department turned down this case because they said, that, I mean, there's no there.
Yeah.
But not Alvin Bragg. And he insisted that you
Who's
can...
He's the New York guy.
Alvin Bragg yeah. is the district attorney in New York. And he said that this misreporting of the falsification of a business expense, normally a misdemeanor, mm-hmm. was used to conceal a crime. And if you conceal a crime, that is a felony. Ha, we got him. And the crime was he was trying to thwart the election and prevent people from not voting for him because he figured if the news came out, you see, then they
Honestly,
wouldn't vote for him.
At some point, I knew all of this information,
yeah.
and I feel dumber having heard it again.
No, and that somehow this
silly.
Is like a political contribution to himself. So where are we now?
Look, by the way, just to, as I used to stipulate when we were talking about this, when the Stormy Daniels story first broke and Michael Avenatti was on CNN all the time,
yeah.
the underlying conduct is bad, right? It's dishonest.
No. It's gross.
It's immoral, all those things. But the actual crime such that it is, to me at that time, I argued was like, this seems like a smallish FEC violation. Is that what?
Yeah,
like,
he can get a $150,000 fine. That
right,
can happen.
Right? Right. So now we've trumped it up into this.
Oh, you could
really
possibly go to jail. And everybody's really excited about that because that would be a great way to save democracy. Where we are now, Mary Catherine,
yeah.
is jury selection.
Okay.
Right. I've been through this. I can speak from experience.
I have watched many true crime shows.
Yeah, so multiple times and selected twice because, you know, me. Voir dire.
Voir dire,
the jury selection, they have so far no jurors
okay.
selected. They turned down a number of them. There's a questionnaire. And on the questionnaire, there are such questions as, Have you attended a Trump rally?
Okay.
Have you attended an anti-Trump rally?
Mm-hmm.
Do you have strong feelings that would make you, that would affect your wanting to treat Donald Trump fairly?
Yeah.
Now, to my amazement, a good number of people just said, yeah, I can't. I will admit it. I can't do it. And I'm just not going to do it.
I mean, that's the honest answer for many people.
But you have to assume
there
are people out there who will want to do a tell-all. They have it in for the president, and maybe they scrub their social media and they're going to say, you know what? I'm very fair and I don't follow the news. Who is this person with the orange complexion? You know, I mean, so.
Are you referring to Donald Trump, the successful 80s and 90s era real estate tycoon?
Yeah, the star of Home Alone 2. That's who they're thinking about. So
I have heard of him.
I was listening yesterday on CNN. Ellie Honig was talking, right, their legal course expert, about the importance of jury selection. And he says it is a big deal because they need to find out, for example, the jurors can only come from the borough of Manhattan, but maybe they're from the Lower East Side versus from the Upper West Side. And that could affect who's going to vote for maybe somebody sympathetic to Trump and maybe and not. And that would be a problem for the prosecution because, you know, as many as 12% of Manhattan voted for Trump.
OK, you know what I want? If you're going to hold it in New York City, let's say, all Staten Island.
Oh, yes. No, that would be
nothing but Staten Island jurors.
Yeah,
that's your best.
Can
shot.
I be even more blunt? If that had a, if we were counting all the if we were counting all the boroughs, I'd say try to find out their zip codes. Right? Staten Island and last names have to end in a vowel. Sorry. That's to my friends from Staten. I love Staten Island. So that's where we are now. And of course, it's still the case still rests on their star witness, Michael Cohen, who's very credible.
Did you see that MSNBC had Michael Avenatti on?
No.
From jail.
No. I was going to say, isn't he still in jail?
To talk about this. He is jailed on, like, I believe it was fraud.
Yeah. Regarding Stormy Daniels.
Regarding in part Stormy Daniels. He is nonetheless still on MSNBC, and he weighed in on this trial from jail. I was waiting for, like, the collect call, like, you have 1 minute left from the so-and-so Corrections Institute. Yeah. Anyway, he spoke about this, and he kind of undercut, I believe it was Ari Melber's show, he undercut the liberal take on this. He was like, you know, I don't think this is a strong case, and I don't think he'll get a fair jury trial in New York City.
Wow.
I mean
he could say, yeah, well, you know what? What has he got to lose now?
I mean,
you know, the ultimate thing for him to do would be like a double heel turn, if you will.
Yeah.
You know, and suddenly be like on the right side because that was
star
would,
representative of Donald Trump himself, Michael Avenatti.
He could out Cohen Michael Cohen. That would be really
And he was trashing Michael Cohen, which is probably why he was actually there. Like, that was the point.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
But I still believe that he will get convicted.
Yeah.
A jury.
No, I think that's the
judge.
Case. Well, and that's what
Avenatti
was saying.
It'll be a big celebration. Yeah.
That's what Avenatti was saying. It's like,
really?
You know, this jury pool
go.
is going to convict him.
Yeah. And, you know, I don't know how good Trump's lawyers are, but even if he had really good ones.
MSNBC with a headline about this interview. Michael Avenatti gives his first interview from federal prison. Oh, was that the news, guys, there? Was that the news? I feel like there was some other news in there. That guy's still getting more airtime than I am, and he's in prison. Did we talk about the incentives? Anyway. Yeah.
There's other things you wanted to talk about, Mary
I know.
Catherine,
you
on
know
the
what?
Show.
We have time for maybe one of
you
them?
Pick.
Okay.
You pick.
We're going to do NPR
Players
briefly.
Players' Choice. Oh, yeah.
And then I will save the cast report.
Great.
Our cast review on gender-affirming treatments of youth in Britain and in the NHS for later this week. Because I do think it's important, but we don't have time for it today. So, NPR. We didn't get to this last week, but Uri Berliner.
Yes.
Uri Berliner, who has worked for NPR for 25 years, is definitely a left-of-center man.
Sure.
Wrote for the Free Press last week, I've been at NPR for 25 years. Here's how we lost America's trust. In this piece, he talks about all the things that you and I take as obvious about NPR.
Yeah, we've known this, right?
It leans very far left. That its listeners lean very far left. Berliner makes the point that it is now much worse than it used to be. That yes, conservatives have this idea of it, but the change in the listenership and in the news coverage has been major during, in particular, the 2020s. But he says back in 2011, Although NPR's audience tilted to the left, it still bore a resemblance to America at large. 26% of listeners described themselves as conservative, 23% as middle of the road, and 37% as liberal. By 2023, the picture was completely different. 11% described themselves as very or somewhat conservative, 21% as middle of the road, and 67% of liberals said they were very or somewhat liberal. And he said this leads to an open-minded spirit at NPR and an intellectual curiosity no longer existing.
Yeah.
And it led to, and this is the important part, it's not just a complaint about DEI or bias or everyone being liberal. It is, at its heart, a complaint about getting stories materially wrong.
Yeah.
Because of those
biases. Because you're so driven by, we got to get this. Right.
So he mentions, among other things, Russiagate, Hunter Biden, a laptop, which NPR was very ostentatiously not covering.
Right.
They put out a story that says, we preemptively announced that this story is not news and it's below us. I mean, just the opposite of a news organization. COVID coverage, he talks about, including the lab leak theory. So he points to these major, major storylines that they messed up. Now, he's still working at NPR when this is published. It's a risky move.
Yes.
Right? Today, he has been suspended.
I was going to say,
for 5 days. NPR reported on his suspension. So I do kind of feel for the media reporters who have to do this work, right?
Yeah.
Like
their own colleagues.
Their own company has suspended a dude who wrote critically about the organization.
Right.
And a reporter has to go and ask him about that and then ask management about it. Notably, NPR did not comment on the story that NPR wrote about suspending this guy.
Is Berliner in a re-education camp right now? Is that what happens?
Okay, so I have a slightly unpopular take here. Writing something like that about your organization is a bit like civil disobedience for your workplace, right?
Yeah.
So you have to imagine that there might be some punishment that comes with this. Now, they say the 5-day suspension is because he violated their rule of not clearing stuff before it. Not clearing the outlet you're writing for whatever piece you're writing with NPR. Fine. If that's in the rule book, I can be okay with that.
5-day suspension.
Right.
I hope Free Press paid him well.
You know what? You know what should also come with that, right? He takes his lumps.
Yes.
You take your lumps.
Right.
And say, your lumps are more important because you messed up a bunch of national stories in your capacity as a news organization, and you should answer for those. But that is not what's happening.
No, they're digging in, aren't they?
Yeah.
So there's a lot of focus on NPR's new head, is it?
Yes. So that's Catherine Marr.
Yeah.
You know that thing where the press does. By the way, one of the things I love about a press story like this is that they act so differently than they require the rest of us to act. Like if NPR goes to a corporation and says, "Hey, this whistleblower said you did all these things.
Right.
What do you have to say about it?" And they say, "No comment." That's not going to fly at NPR. If then they ask the corporation, "Oh, you suspended this whistleblower. Right. What do you have to say for yourself?"
Right.
And NPR says, "We're not commenting." They would not also be okay with that. So it's like, it's wild the way they treat people. Catherine Marr is the CEO, appointed in January. Apparently she was before that head of Wikipedia. So two very, very powerful,
very powerful
spots
in
the sort of cultural news.
Yeah.
What am I trying to say? Pantheon.
Yeah, yeah.
Of
people rely
America
for information, especially Wikipedia.
We've now done the thing. The conservatives have done the thing that the media does, and the media is not happy about it. Which is, the tweets have been unearthed. Tweets have been unearthed, guys.
Yeah.
And by that, I mean that people went back to 2020 and looked at her tweets.
I was going to say they didn't have to go back too far.
No, and she's saying things like, "Hey, rioting is understandable." She's making reference to her own cis white mobility and how it keeps her from she has to acknowledge these things when she deals with the news. Matt Taibbi wrote a whole thing about the holidays with Catherine Marr, and it was like every single possible signaling tweet you could do about Thanksgiving, Christmas, like the indigenous
people.
How do you
live like that? Are these people happy? Because
that was his argument, is how does a person like this seek happiness? I don't know if she's going to find it in this position anymore. No. But yes, so people are highlighting that.
Yeah.
And Berliner, for his part, he of course says in this piece, reported by NPR that I love NPR and feel it's a national trust. We have great journalists here. Mm-hmm. If they shed their opinions and did the great journalism they're capable of, this would be a much more interesting and fulfilling organization for our leaders. So he spoke to an NPR reporter about Mars specifically, again, brave.
Yeah.
And he says, we're looking for a leader right now who's going to be unifying and bring more people into the tent and have a broader perspective on sort of what America is all about. And this seems to be the opposite of that. And if you look at her tweets, I mean, truly, that's the thing. This is not a person who's capable of bringing broad perspectives.
Right. I mean, you know, I mean, you're entitled to your opinion that Trump is racist and fascist dictator, but she's throwing it out there on social media. She's saying these things, and Oscar's so white, as you were mentioning, all the various,
all the things.
You feel compelled that you must chime into every single thing. And then the looting thing where she said, you know, it's really hard to feel bad for these store owners because of your privilege. Are a lot of those store owners, the people who own convenience stores and 7-Elevens, are they all white?
Yeah, they're very privileged and white. No, the thing is that, like, she is privileged and white, and this is how she keeps her powerful positions, is laying down for this stuff and signaling as hard as
possible.
She's got
to cover herself. Yes. It's all CYA.
That's how she keeps her job.
Who knows if she feels that way. It is interesting when you talk about the shift in the demographics, the political demographics of NPR listeners, which has always been, as we know, liberal, but even now more so. And then they find themselves chasing after that audience and beholden to that audience, which is, again, not good.
It's wild. And look, here's the thing. I come from a news family. Like, my dad was a newspaper editor. I am a fourth generation newspaper journalist. You can take that as a bad reflection on me or a positive one. But many generations of journalism in the family. Mm-hmm. And in this career, I have often had the position of, like, help me help you. Yeah. Help me help you. Yeah. I would like to help you see beyond the very small world in which you are cloistered, which, by the way, is even more cloistered these days because of the decline of local news, which means none of these people in the pipeline from Columbia to the national news ever have to go to Omaha or, oh, heaven forbid, an even smaller city or town to cover normal people. Right. And so they end up straight up at the national news. Their bubbles are even smaller.
Yeah.
And the normie adjacent among us are not even welcome in those circles. But I've always been like, help me help you. They don't want to be helped.
No.
They want to be helped. They don't want to be helped by Yuri Berliner. They don't want to be helped by Barry Weiss.
We're perfectly fine the way we are. And by the way, our opinions are not, you know, they're not opinions, they're fact.
For her part, and just to illustrate how little interest there is in accountability here, Mara says, questioning whether our people are serving our mission with integrity based on little more than the recognition of their identity is profoundly disrespectful, hurtful, and demeaning. This is totally non-responsive to Berliner's piece.
Yeah.
Totally non-responsive, just dripping in condescension, arrogance, no need to examine ourselves, and smearing the guy who wrote a perfectly clear piece about what he's objecting to. And this is the answer. There was a clip from Katie Couric this week.
Oh, yes.
And we can play.
Oh, yes. With Bill Maher.
And I feel like, to your point, Bill, the socioeconomic disparities are a lot, and class resentment is a lot, and anti-intellectualism and elitism is what is driving many of these anti-establishment, which are Trump voters,
right,
or anti-establishment
Absolutely.
Voters. So I think that is a huge problem that we have to address. I mean, globalization and, you know, the transition from an industrial to a technological society. I mean, I don't know if you've ever been jealous of what someone else has or resentful. It is such a corroding and bitter, almost bile feeling. Right.
She says MAGA is driven by anti-intellectualism and anti-elite sentiment.
Mm-hmm. Resentment.
I want to say that Couric is right. A lot of America is filled with anti-intellectual and anti-elite sentiment. And that is because our intellectual elites are neither intellectual nor elite. They are bad at their jobs. They are not intellectually curious. They get a ton of stuff wrong. They never look at themselves and ask why they got a ton of stuff wrong.
Yeah.
I get a ton of stuff wrong too. Feel free to correct us, by the way. just look inward. That is part of the process. And they refuse to do it. And that's where that lack of trust, that's where that resentment comes from. It is earned by them.
Yeah.
Catherine Marr?
I'll just say this, which is NPR should be concerned because they can say all this and they can dismiss it, whatever. The fact is they're taxpayer funded and they could lose their taxpayer funding, especially under Speaker Hakeem Jeffries.
We will save them from that fate for sure. One last thing.
Yes.
NPR's embattled CEO, Catherine Marr, this is reported by Sean Kennedy, will be at the Carnegie Endowment HQ for a talk this week on disinformation, journalism, and technology.
Yeah.
A conversation with Catherine Marr. So unsurprisingly, this not at all intellectually curious person who will not take accountability for the tribalism and bubble she has created in her organization or been part of in her organization is going to tell us what the correct information is and what the bad information
is. They always know better. Don't you know that?
GTFO, man. All right.
I have a call out, Mary Catherine. Two call outs, really. Okay, one is listener Jeff. He has the answer to the Kamala Harris 2022 basketball, women's basketball ridiculous statement.
Okay.
He says, no, what she's referring to was that it wasn't until 2022 that the women's tournament had the play-in game. Quote, quote, the poor ladies did not have the tremendous exposure that comes with those play-in games. Yes. And I have, you know what I used to call the play-in games, right? They're like the top seeds of the NIT. That was the play-in game.
But the play-in game, for those who are not familiar, is like basically the bracket that can't even fit on your sheet of paper. It's on a different sheet of paper.
They call it the top 68 now instead of the top 64.
No, he's right. She's like I said, just like Trump is deeply rooted in the Aramaic and Greek translations of the Bible, and that's why he can endorse the Bible.
Yes.
Kamala Harris is deeply into the brackets and how they've evolved and the NCAA in general. Over the past
only a few of them
century.
Were broken. I do. I also really quickly just also want to thank once again the folks at Cardistine, the folks at the University of Notre Dame, and the students who were very helpful. We had a great discussion with the editorial staff of the Irish Rover at dinner, and I asked them like, "What is the scene like?" You'll be comforted to know that not a lot has changed in terms of like where they go out, what they do, the studying. I mean, it's a lot of that in certain bars. And they were telling me, they were warning me against, like, you don't want to go to certain bars. I said, which ones? You go, whatever bars, it's only like where the freshmen and the sophomores hang out.
Okay.
And I definitely didn't go there that night. That wraps up this episode of Getting Hammered. Remember, you can subscribe to us on iTunes, Google Play, and YouTube. You can follow me on Twitter at Victorina Mattis.
I'm trying to finish the show, everybody. I'm jumping in there. I'm at MK Hammer on Twitter, at MK Hammer Time on Instagram. You can follow the show at Getting Hammered Podcast on YouTube and Instagram so you can see our lovely faces. I did put on makeup today. So, all right. Thanks for getting hammered responsibly. Don't get lost in a maze. This has been a Nebulous Media Podcast.